Happy Friday to you all, and welcome to the Week in Review, where we go beyond the headlines of the last 7 days and take a deeper dive into what they mean and how you should think about them. It's the Friday tradition here on KUOW. Bill Radke, the carrier of that tradition, has the day off, but the show goes on. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News sitting in for him this hour. So the week began with that tragic Amtrak train derailment here in our region that generated a national discussion about rail safety. Three people were killed and several injured when a train went off the tracks and onto I-5 near DuPont. It was the first time the daily Amtrak train had taken a new bypass route between Tacoma and Olympia, which was just completed to help speed up travel times. Here are some sounds from the crash scene and the aftermath.
Amtrak 501 answering Centralia North, over.
Hey guys, what happened?
We were coming around the corner to take the bridge over I-5 there, right north into Squally, and we went on the ground.
Okay, are you, is everybody okay?
I'm still figuring that out. We got cars everywhere and down onto the highway.
Next thing I know it, the train is kind of leaning to the left. I feel like that wasn't a good feeling. And the second that I discovered wasn't a good feeling is when my cart completely twisted. And glass people were all coming towards me, flying in the air.
Preliminary indications are that the train was traveling at 80 miles per hour in a 30 mile per hour track.
We have to keep this as a wake-up call. It's not acceptable that we are involved in these kinds of accidents. We're terribly sorry to the people that are involved.
Still no definitive answer about the cause of that crash, though investigators are looking into whether the chief engineer was familiar enough with that new route or perhaps distracted by another person in the cab at the time of the accident. Jessen Farrell joins us today. She is the former Democratic state senator from Northeast Seattle. This line really was a partnership between Amtrak, the state, Sound Transit actually owns the right-of-way, it turns out. You obviously spent a lot of time with WatchDOT and Olympia. Your thoughts on this and what it means?
Well, thank you for having me today. I think that this really is about the importance of government coordination, safety regulations, and that it's no joke. We're in an era where the partisan divide has turned government and governance into a spectator sport, into clashes of gladiators. And it's not a joke. It's not a game. And at the end of the day, that coordination, that work around communication, safety regulations, those are about people's lives. And that's what this is about to me.
Also here today, John Carlson from KVI Radio. John, we just learned the NTSB issued this few hours ago that a cell phone was actually not being used.
Right.
He may have been distracted, but not by a cell phone at least. Your thoughts?
Well, it's now become a mystery because whenever something awful like this happens, there's one of four reasons, four rationales. The first is catastrophic mechanical or brake failure. The second, something wrong with the track, the rail bed. Third, possible terrorism or vandalism. Fourth, human error. And now we're zeroing in on the latter, and it's not clear why a train where there had been several dry runs, several practice runs, was going so fast around a curb where there was no way it could negotiate it. So, you know, the mystery deepens here.
Knut Berger also joins us. You are from Crosscut. You're a train guy. You and I have talked about trains in the past. You're an avid rider. You've probably been on this route. Your thoughts?
Well, I haven't been on the new route, but I've been on the old route. Well, I'm very sympathetic with the people who were injured and the families of those, and as well as the people who were killed. I think my reaction is, firstly, just following up what John was saying, is you want to know what happened. And often these things are complicated. I've watched a lot of those videos of the NTSB investigating airplane accidents, and often there's more than one cause. Often there are multiple things in play, and all of those are being looked at right now. And one of the things is the speed with which this route was adopted and whether or not other safety measures like the positive train control system could have been put on this track from the very beginning. So I think it's going to be really interesting and to find out, you know, why they were doing 80 and a 30.
Jessen, Knut Berger brings that up, this speed of not the train, but the timeline of getting this part open. They originally had planned to unveil this new bypass in 2019. The state sped that up. There's more reporting that they were trying to meet a deadline. The feds, who were part of a match here to create this $180 million bypass, had, I think, this summer as a deadline. So was that part of the problem?
Well, I think we have to, you know, as Knut was saying and as John was saying, there are a lot of questions about this. And so before jumping to conclusions around that issue particularly, you know, we do need to find more answers. But if that was an issue, we know that ARRA funds had been extended in 2015, that the state had worked with the Obama administration at that time to spread out the timeline. And that's really concerning if there was a fear that the money was going to go away. But I would also say that the urgency around the safety measures is a real question as well. There are some reports that BNSF had slow walked some of the positive train control regulations several years earlier. So there are a lot of questions around several players in this story. And again, I think it comes down to that essential question of governance and how important it is because it affects people's lives.
John Carlson, this positive train control system, it was planned for this route, not yet unveiled. Some Amtrak routes throughout the country, some other freight routes do have this. This didn't. Basically, what would that have done if it was in place?
Well, it would have, to simplify it, it would have put the train on autopilot. And as soon as it was entering a condition where the speeds were much higher than the conditions, it would have automatically slowed it all down.
And that's
every train route in the country was supposed to have this a couple of years ago, and there have been waivers signed to slow walk it. It was supposed to be on this particular route, I think, sometime in 2018.
One thing we're just learning, this just came across the wire, Wall Street Journal is reporting that the original plans for that bypass had them straightening out this curve, apparently. There wasn't supposed to be this curve, but for cost-cutting reasons, the curve was preserved to keep the cost down. That is according to a Wall Street Journal report. So we will continue to learn more about how this all happened. Is this a funding issue partly, Knut? You know, you look at some of the rail lines in Europe, some of the other developed countries, they have a lot better safety records, and they also fund at a lot higher level. I mean, by almost any measure, percentage of GDP or percentage of you know, money per passenger, all the rest. Do you think that is part of the problem?
Well, yeah, I think part of the problem is we're not investing in rail the way we should be. And it's an eye opener for any of us who've, you know, travel overseas. I've been on high speed rail in Korea, where you've got seamless internet, absolutely, you know, fast trains blasting across. You can do work while you're sitting there. It's just, you know, it's amazing. And countries that have a lot greater efficiency. And that, in terms of policy, one of my first responses to the accident, you know, is thinking, you know, this points to one of the reasons that we would benefit from having modern, you know, high-speed rail, you know, throughout the Pacific Northwest. I would like to see it go from San Francisco to California. And I think that it's expensive to do, but I think those kinds of investments, you know, would really pay off.
John Carlson, the point of the bypass was, among other things, to make this route more efficient. I mean, it cut off about 10 minutes of travel time between Seattle and Portland. The old route kind of had to curve around Point Defiance, and it slowed things down. They had to kind of share the route with trains and stuff. That's why this was been on the list for a long time to do. It also allowed Amtrak to actually add, I think, 2 extra trains a day. So adding more trains, more capacity. Is rail the future, or are
no,
we
ever? No, it's the past. mean, one of these days, we're going to figure this out. It is, rail is, I understand the romance with rail. It's very much a part of American heritage. But no, it's not going to be part of our future. As we see in California, it is a massive cost overrun, as we're seeing with Sound Transit 3. Sticker shock when people realize just what it would cost to run light rail into Snohomish County, Payne Field, and other places. I think that the future of transportation in this country is where we see electric cars, driverless cars. I think that having mass transit, I would rather have mass transit be not fixed on a particular rail bed so that it can move where communities move, where people move. That's why I didn't want Sound Transit 3 or Sound Transit 2. I wanted a massive expansion in van pools and bus service.
You recently were at the state, Justin Farrell, spent a lot of time on transportation issues and spent a lot of time funding rail.
Mm-hmm. So John and I have been talking about transportation and transit issues for a long time, and we have some really different opinions about this. I think that a modern transportation system is an integrated, multimodal network of a whole set of ways to get around. And the best transportation networks have redundancy in it. So if there's a truck that rolls over on the Alaskan Way Viaduct that's full of fish and shuts everything down, there are other ways to get around. There are rail lines, there are bus lines, there's walking and biking infrastructure. So modern networks are actually based on resiliency, on multiple ways of getting around. And I think when we look at transportation, there are a whole set of values that come into play. What are we thinking about the environment? Obviously, train and rail and bus infrastructure matters in terms of cutting our carbon footprint. There's the issue around time. Driverless cars and electric cars are really interesting and are going to play an increasingly large role in our transportation network, but you're still stuck in traffic. And so the question then becomes, how are we investing in a transportation network that meets people's needs in the whole variety of way that people tend to get around?
And finally, Knut Berger, we know where you stand on rail. You want high speed, but how do you get people into it?
Well, that's a really great question, because I agree with the multimodal. I don't think self-driving cars are and high-speed rail are mutually exclusive. People are investing massively in rail in countries all over the world. In China, they're building a route now from Beijing to Moscow, and one of the major reasons, in addition to passenger and commerce, is movement of freight and that kind of thing. So it makes all kinds of sense still. It's not a technology that's going to go away.
Okay, we wrap up that part of the program. Coming up later...
The one place where I see rail making sense is where you have density. Rail makes sense in London. It makes sense in Paris. It makes sense in New York City. Not so much in Linwood.
It is most popular in the northeast part of the country here, and you have those populated corridors like Boston, New York, New York, D.C., and that kind of stuff. You're right, out west, less so. We move on. Coming up, is Value Village pretending to be more of a charity than it actually is? That's what the state attorney general says. We will get into that today debate. But first, the historic tax cut package approved this week represents President Trump's first major legislative accomplishment. Who wins and who loses? Carlson, Berger, and Farrell weigh in when the Week in Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to KUOW and the second to the last Week in Review before this very eventful year comes to a close. Bill Radke will be back next Friday for that, but today he is enjoying some holiday time off. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News, keeping his seat warm while he is out. Joining me are three voices you have heard here in the program before, but not actually ever on the same show in the same room. So this is a first for this troika. Justin Farrell, a former Democratic state representative from Northeast Seattle. Knut Berger writes prolifically at crosscut.com. And John Carlson talks prolifically every weekday on KVI Radio from 6 to 10 a.m. And you can follow our conversation.
I also write for Crosscut, too,
there you
by
go.
The way.
There you go. But probably more prolifically on the
Not
radio.
As prolifically as Skip.
And, of course, you can follow our conversation on Twitter at KUOW. Now, this week, Congress passed a historic $1.5 trillion tax cut package. Republicans argue it will help spur economic growth. Democrats say it just enriches those who are already well off. Earlier this morning, President Trump signed the deal into law, and so it's ready to go into effect after the first of the year.
And I consider this very much a bill for the middle class and a bill for jobs. And jobs are produced through companies and corporations, and you see that happening. Corporations are literally going wild over this, I think even beyond my expectations.
Now, every Democratic member of the Senate and the House voted against the measure, including Susan DelBene from our state's first congressional district.
This bill takes care of corporate special interests, the wealthy and the well-connected, while putting middle-class Americans' finances and health care on the chopping block. We need tax reform that helps middle-class families. This bill does the exact opposite.
Justin Farrell, as I said, Democrats were united in their opposition, especially that it will not help the average worker, the average middle class person here in the country. But the corporate tax cut, which seems to be the most unpopular from Democrats, has already led to a number of businesses announcing bonuses and wage increases. And that is just since the vote on Wednesday. So isn't it already working?
Well, where did they find that money since they won't be getting that tax credit until 2018? I think what's interesting about this bill is that you really get to see what the Republicans agree on. They agree on trashing the planet by opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling. They agree on taking away people's health care by getting rid of the individual mandate. And they agree on making the rich even richer.
And we should just say those three items are all in this package. Not all. It wasn't a clean tax cut package.
There was all kinds of things that Republicans have been hungry for a long time. And so the issue to me about the corporate tax cuts is, let's talk a little bit about how that works. Taxes are a line item for a corporation. And so when you cut that line item, it goes right into profits. Who gets profits in a corporation? Shareholders. It does not then necessarily follow that that money goes into wages. In fact, we have done this experiment before in the 80s. You know, not so many years ago, and we've been in an era of wage suppression. So there is not a history of putting that money back into wages. In fact, it ends up going right into the pockets of the very, very wealthy.
John Carlson?
Well, yes. Thank you for bringing up the 80s. I mean, we cut taxes across the board in the 1980s. And for the next 7-8 years, we ended up with an average growth rate of 4.5%. For the last 8 years, the growth rate has been about 2%. President Obama is the first president since Herbert Hoover to never get 3% economic growth. So this is a two-tiered program. The first is to lighten the tax burden on businesses, large and small, which this unquestionably does, so that it'll be less expensive to create jobs and convert part-time jobs into full-time jobs. The second is to give everybody a tax break. And this does help middle-income people. This does help people who are working class. This does help people who are upper middle income. And yes, because it takes down the top rate for everybody at every economic strata, helps the wealthy as well. But the bottom line is, will it result in more economic growth? And I'm thinking yes. Jessen and the Democrats are thinking no, but we'll see.
Let me just get some of the facts out so people know the specifics. For individuals, the levels go down, everyone's tax mm-hmm. levels. So, for instance, the highest rate of 39.6 currently would go down to 37%. One of the middle rates, there are several, but one of the middle rates of 28% would go down to 24%. One of the lower rates, 15%, would go down to 12%. So, you know, 3 or 4% drop in almost every tax bracket. The corporate tax would drop from 35% to 21%. Knut Berger, where are you at on this?
Well, I think the bill is really wrong on all fronts. And I want to challenge something that John said, which is President Obama it was like he got to take over the Titanic once it had hit the iceberg. And when you talk about growth in his time, he was dealing with the Great Recession, which was triggered before he became president.
As Reagan
and so,
did.
And it, yes, but you know what's interesting is we're not in a recession right now. And the Reagan tax breaks helped get us out of a recession. Nobody's ever done what they've done, which is this massive giveaway in times of growth and high employment. The economy is, you know, has been doing quite well. And I think that the social engineering that's going on in this bill is to make the rich richer. It is trickle down, which is baloney. And it is not helping perhaps a struggling middle class. And I think bolstering the middle class is the way we should go forward with America's future. So, and I also,
and what would you have done? Just give middle class tax cuts and not the upper level tax cuts? I mean, what would your preferred plan have been?
I don't have a preferred plan. I didn't sit down, and I'm not. And the interesting thing is that the Republicans put a lot of stuff in this bill and never put it through any kind of objective analysis before they put it in. They were putting in favors for each other, admittedly.
Yeah, there were no hearings.
No. And so you had, in terms of public process, in terms of government process, I mean, imagine how John would be howling if the Democrats did this. And you probably
did do it on Obamacare.
Yeah. All right.
The Affordable Care Act.
So are you appalled at this process?
I'm appalled at the results of the process with Obamacare.
No, are you appalled with the process of this tax bill?
No, because these ideas are not new. This debate, Skip, has been going on for years.
Let me jump.
And if I could jump in,
yeah.
I think the word appalling is really important because these ideas are appalling. We know exactly what works to get the middle class spending, and that's investing in the middle class. Let's remember that our economy is 70% consumer driven. And so by focusing tax cuts on the very wealthy, we are actually missing an opportunity to grow our economy by investing in the middle class, whether that is...
What does that mean?
Wage supports, you know, the overtime rule that got repealed by Trump, which would have raised people's incomes, focusing on those costs like education, housing, putting more money in the pockets of the middle class is what...
So would you have, among other things, just kept the tax cuts at the kind of middle and lower levels and not touch the higher tax rates?
That would have been one thing to do. The fact that we reduced things like mortgage deductions and deductions for charitable giving.
For the wealthy.
Well, but if you live in a property wealthy state like New Jersey, that's going to impact people who are maybe not especially wealthy, but happen to live in a place where property values are high. So what you have is a tax bill that was really focused on punishing the enemies of the Trump administration and feathering the pockets of his friends.
Would you have brought down the top rate on business?
If we were going to do something like that, I would want to require that those businesses are investing in wages.
John, let me follow up just kind of in a big picture here. Don't want to get too into the weeds on these specifics.
Sure.
But most groups that have looked at this, independent groups, say this will increase the deficit. There's debate about mm-hmm. whether it will be by $500 billion or a trillion, but certainly basically everyone says it will. What happened to the Republican worries about debt? I mean, they were very energized and critical of Obama for debt spending, but they don't seem to care that now they're in control.
The debt over the last 10 years has gone from $11 trillion to $20 trillion. By 2028, the debt was scheduled, all things remaining as they were, to be about $30 trillion. Because of this tax cut package, if it doesn't work as advertised by its supporters, the debt will be $31 trillion instead of $30 trillion, which Nancy Pelosi calls Armageddon. If, on the other hand, it unleashes a tide of economic growth everywhere, not just where it's already being enjoyed in places like where we're sitting, then you will see unanticipated revenue to bring down the deficits. And that's the only way we're going to make progress on the deficit or the debt is to start growing the economy. The reason I'm going to push back here on what Skip was saying is that, yes, the economy is doing great in Seattle and in King County, But you look across the country, you've got a lower percentage of the working age population in the workforce than any time since the 70s. Okay, in much of America, it's cold out there, and I'm not just talking about the weather. And that is what this package is designed to reverse.
But you do agree this is not a recession era. I mean, in aggregate, unemployment is at what, 4.5%, and interest rates are low, and wages are starting to tick up a little bit. I mean, what sense is this? Obviously, there are pockets of problems, but one sense is this similar to kind of a Reagan first term recession.
We had developed a mentality where they said, you know, 2% growth is the new normal. And the response from the Republicans, why? The post-war average was between 3 and 3.4%. Why is the new normal 2%? Shouldn't be. And so that's what this package is aiming to reverse.
And I think the new normal is about the fact that people are struggling. I think that John is right, that people are struggling and have been left out of the fact that folks at the very top have done quite well over the last 20, 30 years. And that, again, the notion, and this is, and I think the Seattle experiment, the King County experiment, points to this exactly, which is when you have people who have money to spend on the things like restaurants, like cars, all of those other consumer goods, the economy hums. And that's what we see happening here.
Knut, final thoughts on this?
The new normal is a steady move toward feudalism. The new feudalism.
Meaning?
Well, I mean, that's the whole philosophy, I think, of trickle-down, basically. And I also think that you have to look at this in the context of other moves that the administration has made, such as with the national monuments and shrinking them down, specifically for the purpose of resource exploitation. So I think his plan for boosting the economy is to make the rich richer and give them more opportunity to exploit natural resources and that kind of thing. There is some restraint to growth based on long-term policies that favor conservation and the future. And I don't see any of that in what this administration is doing.
And again, just to remind people, there was this ANWR part of this bill. So that opens the Alaskan Arctic National Wildlife Refuge up in Alaska to drilling. Hasn't happened for 40 years. So advocates say that's a great economic benefit. And obviously, concerns expressed by you on the other side. Okay, coming up, two different regional legacies come to an end. The 747 passenger jetliner and Bakeman's Restaurant. We eulogize them both this hour, but now a quick break. The Week in Review continues in a moment. Back now with the Week in Review, but without Bill Radke. He has a well-deserved day off. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News. As usual, three voices join us today with three different perspectives on the politics of the state and the nation. John Carlson, a conservative morning show host on Cairo Radio. Democrat Justin Farrell is a former state representative from Northeast Seattle and a recent candidate for mayor. And finally, the often politically unpredictable Knut Berger of Crosscut.com, an appropriate outlet for you since you do sort of cross over several ideologies, it seems. This week, new Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan, she announced that the city will be putting $100 million into creating more affordable housing. The money will help create 9 new buildings with almost 900 units, and another 4 existing buildings will be preserved, saving 535 units.
Too many Seattle residents these days are either locked out or pushed out of Seattle. Today, we're making a huge down payment on a more affordable future.
Now, the $100 million comes from a combination of sources, including the voter-approved housing levy and some funds from the city zoning program that requires developers to pay into an affordable housing fund. One fact here, as we get into this discussion, Seattle continues to lead the nation in the rate of increase of housing costs. The average rent for a 2-bedroom topped $2,000 for the first time. Knute Berger, we've got about 400 people moving into Seattle every week. So 1,500 units, which is what this plan would build over the next several years, it takes care of about a month of newcomers. Now, not all of those newcomers are obviously low income, but still, you know, this effort to keep up with just affordable units, it always seems to run short. We never have enough, especially with the immigration. What's your thoughts?
Well, that's true. We're not keeping up, and you're also seeing, in addition to that net growth of people in Seattle, you're also seeing a lot of people leaving Seattle. So. And so while that number is growing, so is sprawl. So are we growing in other places around Puget Sound. I've sort of argued that we need a much more regional approach. I've never liked the idea of Pugetopolis, the sort of big megalopolis, you know, but it's here. That's what we have. But we don't have a governance system that, whether it's homelessness or affordability or whatnot, that's really dealing on a much more regional scale. And that's something I'd like to see happen, because there are places where affordable housing, and a lot of it, could be built less expensively. And you know, mass transit is a key component of that. I just think, you know, and to expect City Hall to solve that problem kind of in and of itself, I think, is...
Like it screams for a regional solution.
I think so,
yeah.
Yes.
Justin Farrell, you ran against Jenny Durkin. Is she checking all the boxes she campaigned on? I mean, this being one of them, affordable housing, homelessness was probably the top issue in the voters' minds. Are you happy with what she's doing?
I would say that this is certainly a start, and being on the campaign trail together, we heard the same thing over and over and over again, the concern about the affordability crisis, whether you are a senior and worried about property taxes or staying in your home, whether you are trying to buy in the city, whether you're trying to hang on to being able to pay rent. I mean, it's an issue that is touching so many people across the city. And so while I absolutely applaud her on making this a keystone and an important announcement, we need to be much bolder. And I think we need to take a regional approach. What would it look like? Just as we have been bold on transportation, $54 billion for transit infrastructure, $20 billion for roads infrastructure in the last few years. What would an ST3 for housing look like? What if we were to say, we are going to approach this with a shared regional vision and the resources to get on top of this?
I mean, you're talking in the billions.
Potentially, you know, 100,000 affordable units. What is it that we need to establish housing stability for people in this region? You look at places like Vienna, and that's a city where 25% of housing there is publicly owned. And that is a city where people can stay, an array of incomes. If you don't want to take a public route, there are private ways to do it. But we need to look at how do we increase the housing stock to meet the need.
John Carlson?
Well, one of the other hats that I wear is I'm a planning commissioner in Bellevue. And we reached the conclusion that if we want to maintain the integrity of single-family neighborhoods, and we also want affordable housing, we need more supply, and we need it, we decided, in three key areas. We need it downtown Bellevue, where density would be welcome. We need it in Eastgate, which has been rezoned. Eastgate is the part of Bellevue that you'll see when you're driving on I-5 up Bellevue Community College. And we need it in a new area called the Spring District. That is where we are trying to channel as much housing as possible. This really all gets down to supply. 100,000 units that Jessen talks about for the Seattle area makes sense. The challenge is, where are they going to go? And I think, by the way, the homeless issue, if we're talking about the homeless issue that we see when we're driving, we see the tents, we see people wandering the streets, I think that is a separate issue from affordable housing, where you have people barely able to hang on to a one bedroom. Maybe they need a roommate. Maybe they need a studio. They have to make accommodations. Are we making it easy for mother-in-law apartments? Are we making it easy from a regulatory standpoint to build more affordable housing?
Justin, you talked about adding more money to this. This segues into another story that came out of City Hall this week, which is that Seattle has been on quite a spending binge. According to the Seattle Times, Mayor Murray, who was in office for basically 4 years, general funding fund spending. And when we talk about the general fund, this is sort of not including the utilities, City Light, Seattle Public Utilities. They're sort of run as a business and, you know, fees just pay for those services. But the general fund, transportation, police, all that, that increased about 40% in 4 years under Mayor Murray. Population grew by about 11% over that time. Public safety, transportation, the biggest increases there. You know, on the one hand, Seattleites want this. I mean, part of that spending increase has come from voter-approved levies, and so you could say they have endorsed this. On the other hand, I think a lot of people would look at an article like that and just look at a budget that goes up that much that quickly and say, hey, something's wrong. They're concerned about that. So should we be concerned, or is this exactly what the public wanted? Justin Farrell?
Well, I think there are three points to make. Number one, these are by and large voter-approved measures. There is a deep affirmation of public spending in the city and in this region. And I think the second thing that is deeply related to that is that the state and the federal government have really pulled back from a lot of those things that the city is now spending on, whether it's mental health, whether it's transit, whether it is supports for students, low-income students. These are all things that the city has taken on, and that is in part a result of the disinvestment from the state level and the federal level. I think the third thing to add, though, is that issue around population growth, and that we are a city with 100,000 people moved here in the last decade. That's stunning. And people want a city that meets their needs, whether it's parks, whether it's addressing the mental health issue, the homelessness issue. These are all really important things. And then a final point I'd make is that, of course, we're comparing today's expenditures to a nadir. I mean, we were in the Great Recession 4 and 5 years ago when city spending was at a low. And so, you know, it's kind of a neat trick, I guess, to use a very low point in city spending and a higher point now to make a point and use a word like binge. But I would argue that Seattleites are hungry for a city that works for people.
Knute Berger, is this just kind of makeup spending, or do you worry about the sustainability of budgets that are going up that much every year?
Well, I think you have to look at it in parts, because there's things that are very much worth spending more money on. Housing, for example. There are things that the growth itself drives spending. If you have more utility hookups or more traffic in the streets, or you need more cops or whatever, you're going to have to spend more money to keep up with growth. And although, you know, Seattle is in this weird thing, which is one reason I'd like us to see us redo our taxes. We're so heavily dependent on income from growth that any other philosophy of running the city, runs against the budget. Then there's the whole issue of, pay grades, pay levels, and what city staff are making. And if you notice in that article, there's been this spike in consultants and strategic advisors. Mayor Murray famously went to some of the most expensive places to hire talent to come here and that kind of thing. And that makes me miss Mike McGinn. I mean, McGinn was a tightwad. And, of course, he was mayor at a time when the kind of Greg Nichols era budgets were, the economy had shifted. And so he was sort of forced into that. But it also happened to be a philosophy that he had. And I hope Jenny Durkin and others will look very carefully at those staffing levels, at those ways, because, government does tend to bloat, and so do corporations. I mean, it tends to be when you're in a growth thing, you add on stuff that you, in fact, don't need.
John Carlson?
I think Skip hit it perfectly there at the end, that if government or other big institutions are simply left to maintain the status quo, they will get bigger, they will get fatter, they will bloat. If I'm not mistaken, what was that population increase in the last 4 years?
I think it's 11%.
Yeah, 11%, inflation 12%, and the budget goes up 40%. I noticed in the article the mayor's staff went up 70%. I think it's very important we not fall prey to the temptation that more money means a better operating government, a more efficient government, because oftentimes what it creates are obstacles to more efficiency. and you know, more bureaucracy and less accountability. And I think that's where Seattle is. And yet, is there any appetite on the Seattle City Council to streamline spending? No, but there sure is to impose more taxes. They just keep looking for more taxes, even though they're spending way, way ahead of inflation and population.
And I would say that these things are not a binary. You know, either you're for government services and therefore against efficiency. I think John and Knut are absolutely right that we need to be driving efficiencies into government always. You know, we can talk about lots of examples from all different kinds of things. But at the same time, it is not in contrast to then say, and we still want services. We still want people to have access to mental health services. We still want affordable housing. We still want social workers to help kids and their families in our public schools.
Briefly, Knut?
I was just going to say, I've always been a kind of Jerry Brown Democrat in that sense of fiscal responsibility, that it is incumbent on progressives to be fiscally responsible. Because we believe in government and we have to make it run better. And, you know, I think this goes to the points that John and Jessen are making.
Okay, we take a quick break to reset. When the Week in Review continues, we hear more from Farrell, Carlson, and Berger in a moment. Back now with our Friday Week in Review here on KUOW, the first full day of winter. Three voices from across the spectrum join us to help make sense of the last several days. Knut Berger writes at crosscut.com. Jessen Farrell is a former state representative from Northeast Seattle. And John Carlson with KVI Radio. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News in for Bill Radke, who has the day off. Now this week, a high-profile lawsuit was brought against Value Village. That's the well-known thrift shop similar to Goodwill, only it is not a charity. And therein lies the problem, according to the state attorney general, Bob Ferguson. He is charging that the for-profit company has misled shoppers and donors.
People think they're a charity. They are not. And moreover, they are very explicit in saying you buy something at our store, they suggest that's going to a charity. Zero pennies. Nothing's going to a charity if you buy something at Value Village.
We thank Como News for that clip. Now, John Carlson, you know, Bob Ferguson gets criticized for being a little too trigger happy with lawsuits against the Trump administration. But this case seems to be kind of right in the sweet spot of that job description, consumer protection. I'm not saying the allegations are necessarily true, but this has the kind of hallmark of a typical AG case.
Yeah, well, when the year started, Bob Ferguson had a much better record against Donald Trump than he does as the year ends. But regarding the Value Village thing, I got to admit, I don't get it. A Value Village has never advertised itself as a charity. I mean, it's not like Goodwill. It's not like the Salvation Army thrift store. It is a place that sells, I was going to say secondhand, let's say gently used merchandise instead. And as far as I know, and I've been there, they've never advertised themselves as a nonprofit or as a charity.
Well, that's the claim here, because there's some signage and some mailers that, I mean, I must say, as a guy who shopped there more in my 20s and 30s, you know, thrift shopping years, I was never quite clear about the business model of Value Village. I mean, I've also donated more in recent years, and you get a tax deductible receipt, and I sort of wondered.
It's more like a consignment shop, except they pay you up front.
But I think they in my experience, don't want it to be completely clear what they are. They're not. They can't say they're a charity, but they do donate some of the revenue to charity. So there actually is a charitable mission. So that's why it's not a completely for-profit situation. But Jessen Farrell, I don't know. Have you had any question about the business model of Value Village?
I had not. And the only thing that I'm really trying to rack my brain for is some kind of analogy between the Trump administration and Value Village. And I have to admit, I haven't come up with anything yet. So, but yeah, I mean, I've shopped at Value Village. I assumed that, in contrast to Goodwill and Salvation Army, I didn't associate it with being a charitable outfit, but that doesn't mean that it didn't make statements that it was, but I don't know.
But
honestly,
certainly when you go donate items, you get a receipt, like it's tax deductible, like if you went to Goodwill or Salvation Army donating a few things. This problem came up in Minnesota, so they have been kind of called out on whether they're sort of blurring the lines and not being truthful or completely upfront. It turns out that you know, about 15% of the money they make goes to charity. Those are kind of the best estimates. If you go to Goodwill, it's almost the opposite, like 85% of the money at Goodwill, because that's a complete charity. Skip Berger, are you energized at all by the case against Value Village?
Well, not really. But, you know, some of the things in the article about the lawsuit were interesting in that, I mean, I was familiar with their operations because I worked for a nonprofit that once considered being part of the sort of Value Village. And there was, at that time, this is back in the 80s, there was a kind of promotional benefit as well as a guaranteed revenue stream. They make a lot of money, so they can guarantee charities that participate in the program. And the charities can participate in different ways. Some can just sit there and collect a check for Value Village being able to sort of use their name and say, you know, some of the proceeds go to these charities. The article indicated that they've been passing out stuff in stores for years, saying they were giving to charities that they no longer give to, and really kind of rubbing that line. So the charitable part is part of their business model, and in my opinion is they have to do that very honestly and make it very clear what's going to the charities and what's
and they
not.
Were forced to do more of that in yeah. Minnesota where this company does do business.
I think that's a very fair outcome. The fact that they're making a ton of money selling used clothes, you know, it's a business, and they found a way to make money doing something that people thought was just a good
one more thing is
thing.
They also were the Attorney General's office was trying to get Value Village to write them a very big check.
Yeah, they want
and
some kind of settlement.
And I think that's where the company pushed back and said, this is looking like a shakedown.
Yeah. Okay, we end today with two very different but notable traditions in our region that are coming to an end. Eulogies are in order, I think, for these two different items. First is the landmark last flight for a Boeing 747. It's the end of a 40-year run for Bakeman's Restaurant. That's the other legacy that came to an end this week. Both had an impact on our region, and let's hear what our folks had to say about it. First, a little more color in the 747. It's been known for a while that Boeing was going to discontinue the passenger version of this model. Airlines have been retiring the fleet. But this week marked probably the most notable end of that great tradition when Delta, the last U.S. carrier of a 747, made a last trip of a 747 here to our region. It flew into Payne Field on a farewell tour. It will send the aircraft to a couple other cities for a final time. Employees, other special guests were on board. Of course, notable at Payne Field, that is the site, of course, up there at the Everett facility where the 747s had been manufactured, the first one in 1969. So the touchdown was historic. John Carlson, you're from around here. You were old enough probably to remember the inaugural
service. I was in the fifth grade, Mrs. Flersch's class at Holy Rosary Elementary in West Seattle when they rolled in the black and white television set, rabbit ears, everything.
You saw it take off.
So the class could watch the first 747 being unveiled. It was a great ride and a good run for Boeing. And, you know, of course you miss it, but of course you understand why things move on as well.
Jessen Farrell, things have moved on. Technology, Boeing has smaller planes, really. The idea, I think, was going to be that we were going to get larger and larger and larger planes, and actually the reverse has kind of happened. Smaller and smaller planes have become kind of a fad. You were down to Olympia when you heard a lot about Boeing. You guys gave them some tax breaks. What are your thoughts on this this sort of end of an era for Boeing? And what do you know about their future?
Well, there's a lot of ends of eras that happen. You know, it was a real end of an era when Boeing moved to Chicago, right? I think that, in a way, was almost a bigger statement than the end of a 747, which, of course,
definitely
was a symbol of the heyday of American travel, right? There was something to be said for that. But, you know, we're in an era where we are wrestling with how do we provide a predictable regulatory environment for corporations and ask that they be great corporate citizens. So the tax breaks, for example, and tying that to keeping jobs in this region and the recognition at the same time that those jobs are vital. That the Boeing as a major employer, the major employer matters, and we need to continue to keep that in mind.
Now, another passing to mark, the popular Bakeman's restaurant on 2nd Avenue, downtown Seattle. Obviously, that legacy was not as monumental as of 747, but it did represent an important gathering place, typified kind of Seattle's 70s and 80s. Many politicians lunched there. Many deals were cut there. Maybe it was more important. Maybe even bigger deals than 747 hatched there, were birthed there at Bakeman's. Knute Berger, you know the history of Bakeman's. You ate there a lot. Why was that such an important institution, and what will we lose?
Well, it's interesting. At first, I'll connect it to the 747. They were basically born in the same time period. Mm-hmm. And Bakeman started in 1970. And, you know, this was a period of great struggle in Seattle. There was, Boeing bet the farm on the 747. They could have lost everything. And they did not. Bakeman's was, they started a restaurant downtown in a year when 34 food banks were opened in Seattle because of the great turn out the lights recession of that era. And here, this wonderful little institution, it was like a cafeteria for downtown, mainly government workers and banking employees and that kind of thing. And they operated with the kind of efficiency that I would like to see at City Hall in terms of you come in there for a great sandwich. My preference was their fresh roasted turkey on dark bread, dark on dark, we called it. And but you had to learn the rules of the restaurant. You couldn't dally. You couldn't. You had to be decisive. And if you weren't, you got chewed out.
And you loved it there and going to miss it.
Yes, absolutely.
And does it represent, just in 10 seconds, kind of a loss for Seattle?
Well, it just reminds me of an era when Seattle had this, what Jonathan Rabin called this sort of Scando-Asian culture of hard work and efficiency and egalitarianism.
And with that, we wrap the Week in Review for this Friday, December 23rd. My thanks to John Carlson, Jessen Farrell, Knute Berger, a great conversation. The All-Star Bill Radke is back next week. Until then, have a great holiday for all of us here at KUOW.
Thanks,
C.R. Douglas.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Thanks for listening.